is a little overview of what we're going to be hearing about today. We'll be talking about how community leaders and local officials often focus watershed protection efforts on one or two funding sources, such as the Environmental Protection Agency's Section 319 funds. This approach to funding is understandable given the complexity of the problems, issues, and potential solutions available. Finding public funds, usually in the form of grants, is often the easiest and least politically costly financing solution to very entrenched issues and problems. Yet anyone with experience in designing and managing watershed restoration projects knows that there is not enough public funding or private grants to restore watersheds and habitat areas. Creating a watershed financing plan that identifies and leverages sustainable funding sources is a key to successful implementation of any community effort, including watershed restoration and protection. Essential elements of developing a watershed finance strategy and key steps in the financing planning process will be discussed. Concepts will be demonstrated through presentation of successful watershed finance case study examples. So let's meet our speakers. Our first speaker, Tim Jones, is an environmental protection specialist for the U.S. EPA. Tim has provided environmental finance training to community-based watershed organizations and solid waste managers for over 10 years with the U.S. EPA's Offices of Wetlands, Oceans, and Watersheds and the Office of Solid Waste. Tim provided soil conservation training to farmers and environmental education training to elementary school teachers for over 5 years as a Peace Corps volunteer in Chile and St. Vincent and the Grenadines. Our second speaker, Dan Neese, is the director of the People and Ecosystems Program at the World Resources Institute. Dan comes to the World Resources Institute from the University of Maryland, where he served as the director of the Environmental Finance Center. Throughout his career, he has worked extensively with communities, local officials, and watershed organizations in the Chesapeake Bay watershed and Mid-Atlantic on a broad variety of environmental finance issues. Dan's areas of expertise include financing and environmental policy as it relates to stormwater protection, low-impact development, and green infrastructure. He has written several papers on important emerging issues, including financing land preservation, the role of financing infrastructure, and low-impact development techniques on urban wet weather management. So now that I've introduced our speakers, let's get started. Tim, take it away.
Thank you, Ann. This is Tim Jones from the EPA's Office of Wetlands, Oceans, and Watersheds, and I just want to welcome you to the webcast, which I've heard is sold out. So I think everybody's very interested in this topic or very tired of writing grants. So I'll go to slide 2 now. And this is just an overview slide, sort of what introducing the topic. Dan will be talking about the sources of funding, instruments, and institutions related to watershed finance that can help you do two things. One is to build your organization into a more sustainable one, and also to implement on-the-ground projects. So whether you're a nonprofit, a consultant, or a government agency, I think you'll learn a lot about watershed finance in this webcast, and also hopefully see that we all have a role to play in this enterprise. So turning to slide 3 now, why are we interested in watershed financing? Well, if you look around, while we've made some progress in cleaning up water bodies around the country, we still have a long way to go. And as Ann mentioned earlier, there just aren't enough grants to pay for all of the solutions that we need. The gap in funding is approximately $600 billion over the next 10 to 15 years, just in terms of the wastewater and drinking water systems we have in the country. So indeed, we are at a crossroads. So turning to slide 4, just basically an overview, kind of a roadmap to today's webcast. As I mentioned, we'll be talking about sources of funding, the instruments and the institutions related to finance, watershed finance. And secondly, looking at the process, how to assess your sources, institutional capacity and how to implement strategies. Third, we'll look at some of what are the key elements, what are some of the ingredients you need to create and implement some of these effective watershed financing strategies. And finally, we'll be focusing on two case studies, one in the West Virginia and one in Maryland. The first is a land trust, a nonprofit organization, and the strategies they've used to finance land protection there. And then secondly, a county in Montgomery County, Maryland, and how they have developed and implemented a successful stormwater utility using some of the principles we'll discuss today. So now turning to slide five, leave you with a charge to everybody listening today, and I'm really happy that you're all on board and listening today, and that is to first think creatively about financing mechanisms. As Ann mentioned, grants are one approach, it's one part of the puzzle, but really we have to go beyond them, and it's going to take an open mind really to consider some of these possibilities that Dan will be discussing in a moment. And then secondly, hopefully you'll take some of these ideas back to wherever you work and try some of them out. And of course, EPA is anxious to hear what happened if you do try some of these out. So explore partnerships to achieve this approach. And remember, none of us can do it alone. So I think I'll turn it over to you, Dan, now, and take it away.
Hi, good afternoon. This is Dan. First, I'd like to thank Ann for the promotion. I actually manage WRI's Water Quality and Eutrophication Program, and I'm happy to report directly to the director of the People and Ecosystems Program. So keep me from getting in trouble and not taking over somebody else's position. Let's jump right to slide number seven. I think the best place to start is by defining what financing is. And obviously, the focus of today's discussion is watersheds. But there are a few concepts and terms that I think are going to be important as we move through the presentation. The most important thing is financing is a process. And it's usually a more intensive process than most people realize. But primarily what we're talking about is acquiring, allocating, and investing money or fiscal resources. You'll hear me use a lot of terms interchangeably. We'll talk about revenue and capital and tools and instruments, but really what we're talking about is the management of money and applying that money in the most efficient and effective way possible. The goal of financing is always the same. It is to maximize return. Or maximize the value of investment. It does not matter what's being financed, whether it's public or private, small or large. The goal is always the same. And it's an important concept because what financing is not is why we do anything. Again, it's how we get there. It's how we get there when we actually start applying the process, but it is not why we do anything. Now we're moving on to slide number eight. Why finance? You've already heard two people, and I'm going to make it three, tell you that there aren't enough grants. So I think we've established that point. And what that really means is that financing instead of funding provides a long-term solution to what you're trying to accomplish. And it focuses primarily on efficiency. Efficiency is a word that gets a lot of people uncomfortable because they fear that we're talking about cost effectiveness over actual on the ground results or other things that are important in our community. That's not what we're referring to here. We are assuming that protecting and restoring watersheds is important. What we're going to talk about is how to achieve those watershed protection and restoration goals in the most cost effective way possible. That's the meaning of efficiency that we are going to focus on today. And what we really are saying then, going back to our primary goal, is we're talking about maximizing the community's return on investment. Slide number nine, why finance is a community process. Almost by definition, when you start talking about acquiring and allocating people's money, they're going to get themselves engaged at some point or another. And that's an extremely important part of the process. And so when you move beyond funding and start talking about financing, you by definition incorporate all the institutions, stakeholders and organizations that are going to be necessary. And effective financing, as we're going to talk about later in the presentation, actually mirrors the resource itself. And so watersheds are a really effective way of looking at this issue, because watersheds, by definition, are very complex, and therefore the solutions to paying for and financing watershed protection and restoration are often also very complex. So the financing process provides a really good framework or platform for looking at the restoration effort itself. So next slide. Finally, financing is literally how we get things done. It's basically, in many ways, the foundation of a lot of our environmental and natural resource protection efforts. So again, provides a really good and effective way of talking about implementation and accomplishing our watershed goals. Slide number 11, we just need to basically go through a few core parts of the financing process, and these will work their way into the remainder of the presentation. And there are three that we want to focus on. And it probably goes without saying that we're kind of taking a very high-level kind of financing 101 approach to this presentation, and each of these issues could be a full semester of a college course, obviously. And there are many other financing components that go into very complex financing processes, but all of them, in one way or another, are distilled down to these three things. The first is revenue sources. This is going to make itself clear what we're talking about pretty soon. The other one is instruments, and that is basically the next step or the next connection to those sources. And then finally, the institutions or the organizations that are necessary to implement the financing process. Slide number 12. So we start with sources, and really financing is money. In one way or another, that's what we're talking about here. Financing assumes that there's some type of revenue source or resource. And basically, this is really the most, in my opinion, the most important first step or first consideration in when we're talking about watershed financing, because we're ultimately talking about the payer of the cost. Quite honestly, ultimately the source of any financing effort is us. It's the citizens, taxpayers, ratepayers, it's people. We are the source. And so consider that next time you're participating or evaluating a public debate on how we should pay for something. And when we start talking about whose responsibility it is to pay, ultimately we are the ones that pay. Moving on to slide number 13. Revenue sources for watershed financing specifically are often very diverse, and there are a number of things that you need to look at to determine what revenue sources are most appropriate. The efficiency that's involved with the source, is the source sufficient itself? And what we have seen often in watershed and natural resource protection is that we have a tendency as a community to just go after the amount of money that we think is politically palatable or possible without actually collecting enough money or leveraging the revenue source that is sufficient, and it can often be do more harm than good. Is the revenue source equitable? In other words, who is paying? And here you start to get into issues we don't have time to talk about today, but should the polluter pay or the benefiter pay? All of those things have to be determined. And then finally, obviously, community and political will. This is really where most of the political battles are fought over watershed and natural resource protection financing. Who is going to pay? Where would the revenue source come from? And in my home state of Maryland, it's, for example, an issue that is on the top of everybody's mind right now about how we're going to pay for watershed financing. Slide number 14. Instruments is the second component that we need to talk about. And a lot of people get financing source and financing instrument confused. A financing source, and I apologize, I missed a bullet point on the last slide, but we can talk about that now. We're talking about things like taxes, fees, tolls, things like that. That's the source. That's the source of the money. Again, ultimately, we're all the source of those revenues, but the source for the financing process are those things, taxes, fees, tolls, those types of things. The instruments connect that source to the cost associated with what you are trying to accomplish, and we'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute, but again, the goal is always the same, maximizing return on investment, and the right instruments actually help us achieve that goal. That is the purpose of the financing instruments themselves. Slide number 15, just like with financing sources, how you determine which instrument is most appropriate is determined by things like efficiency, effectiveness, organizational structure, how big the project is, what scale it is. Are we talking about a big water, you know, financing the restoration of the Chesapeake Bay watershed, which is 64,000 square miles, or financing the protection of a local stream or local watershed? The types of instruments you will use to achieve your goal will obviously be very different in those two cases. And then finally, community capacity and priorities. And when we start talking about some of these different financing instruments, you'll see that capacity plays a very significant role in determining which one is most appropriate. Going to slide number 16, we're going to talk about three specific financing instruments. And again, just like sources, there are many of them, and there are many others that we could talk about, but there are three that are critically important that help kind of set the framework in the part of our discussion, especially when we start talking about the process and the case studies. The first is debt. And from a public sector point of view, this is probably the most common and the most important financing instrument. And debt is quite simply an obligation to pay or to do something. And when we're talking about the obligation to pay, we're talking about two things, loans and bonds. And they really are pretty much the same thing. It's just the process for paying the money back is a little bit different. Debt is important because debt is basically the essence of financing. It allows for revenue streams to turn into large sums of money in the short term, and that money can be used to solve critical problems immediately. And that's why debt is so important. You can just look at your own situation of buying a house. If you had to pay the entire cost of the house, which we used to have to do a few generations ago, most of us would not be able to afford to live in a home. It is the ability to use debt to get that allows us to accomplish financing goals. Debt is really important with watershed protection and restoration and natural resource protection and restoration, because time is money, and time is really, really important. And so using debt allows us to implement things right now or today and service that debt or pay it back over time. And that makes a lot of people uncomfortable, especially fiscal people who have a tendency to be fiscally conservative. But from a natural resource point of view, that part of the process is critically important. Acting today is often ecologically necessary, but it also, from a financing point of view, can save a lot of money because of things like inflation and the time value of money and costs. Slide number 17, grants. There have been three of us now who have told you there aren't enough grants, but grants will always be a very important part of the financing process when we're talking about watershed protection especially. Grant funding has served as the foundation for watershed protection and natural resource protection for years, and it will probably continue to be that way. Grant funding is an excellent way to seed programs and to basically, it's kind of like the equivalent of venture capital here. When you have a project or a process that is innovative and in some ways maybe even a little bit risky, it's often difficult to leverage other financing resources, but grants are very good at getting projects seeded and getting them off the ground. There are some kind of, you know, there are basically two forms of grants. The first is government grants, and the ones that, like for instance, 319 grants, those are just kind of one-off apply for grant type programs. But government grants are much bigger in certain watershed areas, specifically looking at subsidies. And so, if you consider, for example, agricultural subsidies, they can be very long-term and actually can be of the foundation of water quality protection programs if used the right way. However, that aside, there are, again, some of these subsidy programs that are long-term. For the most part, grants are not long-term solutions. They are short-term opportunities to move things forward. Slide number 18, market-based programs is a third component that we want to look at. Again, just like everything else, we could have an entire day talking about each of these issues, but the reason that why it's important to talk about them now as one of the key components of the instruments of financing is because not all of financing happens within government or the public sector. A lot of it happens, most of it happens, in our everyday lives, and we've referred to that as the marketplace. And so some examples that you might be familiar with when we talk about market-based programs, trading and offset programs, fiscal incentives, which is using public money to actually create an incentive to do something else. And this can be reducing tax or fee obligations, or it can be that's the primary one. It's the opposite, basically, of taxing. You provide a tax break. Purchasing and transferring development rights. One of the case studies we're going to look at is a land trust that has used land protection as a very effective watershed and water quality protection tool. Even the process of donating an easement is a financing tool or a market-based financing tool. And then finally, voluntary programs. We're going to talk about a couple areas where voluntary financing efforts have been very helpful. That is primarily a market-based approach to watershed protection. We don't see a lot of that right now, but we're starting to see more and more of it. Slide number 19. And the third component that we need to look at is institutions. This is probably the most overlooked component of the three, or part of the financing process. And it's in some ways the most critical part of the process, because again, we go back to our ultimate goal, that is efficiency and to reduce costs. And the right institutional capacity and structure creates efficiency, reduces costs, and allows the financing process to actually happen. For example, we're going to talk about a community that's implemented a stormwater utility. I would argue that one of the most important innovations that has resulted with stormwater financing has actually been the development of institutional capacity in local communities to implement and to finance water quality programs and watershed protection. Clearly, the ability to raise money, the revenue component, clearly using that revenue through different financing instruments is important, but having a place where this is done and done efficiently has been very important, and no more important than in Montgomery County, Maryland, that we're going to talk about at the end of the presentation. So institutions are really, really important. Slide number 20. Institutions come in all shapes and sizes all across the political and community spectrum. Local, state, and federal governments obviously play a very important role in watershed and natural resource financing, but not exclusively. You also have things like utilities and authorities. When I mentioned the stormwater utilities, by definition, they are independent institutions that often can be function outside traditional local or state government. Nonprofits and NGOs. When we go back to the issue of grants, when we say grants for years have served as the foundation, well, the organizations that were getting those grants and that were doing watershed protection were NGOs and nonprofits and watershed organizations. That will continue to be the case. Again, the first case study we're going to look at is a land trust, a private nonprofit that is very, very critical in that community's watershed and water resource protection efforts. So it does not necessarily have to be the public sector that serves this institutional capacity. For-profit corporations and businesses, they are clearly part of the financing solution, and quite honestly, if you're doing the financing, if you're utilizing private revenue, it will be the private sector that serves the institutional capacity. And then, again, we come back to who's the ultimate institution? It's us. And often we play a direct institutional role, especially when we start talking about philanthropic giving. So slide 21 is questions.
Thank you, Dan. We will pause briefly here to take some questions. Let's begin first with those that are submitted online. Just as a reminder, you can submit questions online at any time by clicking on the question mark button at the top of the slides page. Our first question is for Tim. At the beginning, Tim, you mentioned that there was a funding gap, and I didn't quite catch that. It was $6 billion. Is this the gap between the funding needs and the funding resources? Are the grant funding resources? This question is from Mary in Helena, Montana.
Hello, Mary. This is Tim, and actually the gap is a little bit over $600 billion, $600 billion over the next 10 to 15 years for wastewater and drinking water infrastructure.
Okay, thanks, Tim. Now we have some questions for Dan. We had a question from James in Tucson, Arizona, and he's asking, what role can universities play? I am especially interested in the potential roles for faculty, staff, administration, and most importantly, the students.
Wow. Well, I guess, obviously, the primary role for a university or an academic institution is to inform. This actual presentation is sponsored and by the Environmental Finance Center, which is the University of Maryland, and that is the role of the Environmental Finance Center, is to inform on these issues. Looking at specifically the process, other than financing and dealing with watershed or water quality issues that are directly related to that institution, I'm not sure that academic institutions get directly engaged in the process, but I suppose that's possible. I guess the final answer, part of that answer would be research is critically important. Obviously there's a lot we need to know about the watersheds themselves and the physical dynamics of watersheds, but we don't know everything there is to know about what it's going to take to allocate and invest resources in the most appropriate way. So I guess the final part, the main thing is do what you do as a research institution, academic institution. So.
Thanks, Dan. We had another online question from Jennifer in Maryland. She asked if you could please clarify the difference between sources and instruments.
Yeah, and we need to make sure that that's clear before we move on. Source is the money itself. So sources are taxes in many different forms, fees. For example, if your home is connected to a public sewer system, your sewer bill is a source of revenue. Tolls, when you drive through a tunnel or over a bridge, that is a source of revenue. The instrument is what happens with that money or how that money is actually used to hit the ground. That's how the money is invested. So let's take the example of the source, which is a tax. An instrument that you would use is to collect the tax and then issue debt through, say, a bond at the public level. The debt is then used to pay for whatever it is you're trying to accomplish. The revenue source, or the taxes, actually services the debt or pays the money back. So revenue or money itself is the source. The tool or the instrument was debt, which is actually taking that money and turning it into something, actually making it hit the ground. Hopefully that clarified that. And as Ann said at the beginning, if we're not making that clear, I should say I'm not making that clear, let me know when we're done. Send me an email, and I'll try to clarify it further.
Okay, thanks, Dan and Tim. At this time, if anyone would like to ask a question over the phone, please unmute yourself and give us your name and organization before your question.
This is Susan in Honolulu, and the question is a clarification on slide 15, and it has to do with scale. Are you saying that the project size, that is, whether it's local as opposed to regional, influences, if not determines, the right financial component fit?
The answer is yes, and then there's an additional component. Scale can refer to watershed size, or scale can be geographic. So, for example, where we are speaking to you from is within the Chesapeake Bay watershed. It is an interstate watershed, so the types of financing tools and instruments are affected by the fact that we have multiple jurisdictions and states, so there's certain things we can and cannot do because of that. So having it within a single jurisdiction or community influences the types of tools that you can have. But scale also refers to the size of the financing effort, if it's a lot of money or a little bit of money. So if it's a $2 million upgrade to a wastewater treatment plant, then the appropriate tool or instrument would be, again, debt or some other form of debt or bond, something like that. If it is a $2,000 community tree planting exercise, you probably don't need to issue a bond to get the revenue to do that. It can be raised in other places. So again, scale is geographic, but scale is also a fiscal issue.
Any other questions?
Hi, this is Elaine, live from EPA here, Region 8. I just had a question. In your experience, how common have you found maybe opportunities where utilities and watershed groups have collaboratively work together on, say, a source water protection plan or a watershed protection effort? And if not, what do you think are the key barriers that would need to be overcome to make that type of collaborative effort more commonplace?
I'm not sure who you were asking the question to, Tim.
To either one, whoever may have that experience or knowledge.
I think Tim does, so.
Well, there are examples of environmental organizations such as our National Estuary Programs that have worked with utilities. One of the primary roles is through education, educating the public about the importance of protecting the natural resource, and that builds support for user fees. That is a primary one. There's also outreach and education that can be done, for example, on water conservation, water efficiency, that can help utilities reduce their costs and focus on other priorities. And so similarly, if an environmental group is helping out with green infrastructure, things that would reduce stormwater runoff into the utility and thereby reduce the burden on the storm on the wastewater treatment plant, the utility, that would be a good partnership to work with. And I'm sure there are more. Yeah, here's Dan for more.
Well, I'll just give you two places that you may want to look into. The first, the one that everybody looks to and talks about, is New York City and their source water protection effort, which relied on a partnership with local community and watershed groups in the upper part of the watershed. A lot has been written and researched on that particular case study. And then another one is Philadelphia and the response to their source water assessment. They have not had the financing component like New York City has had, but it has been a very good collaboration among the utility and a lot of community groups that have participated in that partnership. That's specifically referred to as the Schuylkill River, and a lot of work has been done there.
Thank you, Dan and Tim. I think this time we're going to move on to our next session. So back to you, Dan, for the presentation. Moving on to slide 22.
All right, now we're just talk about the process of financing itself, and actually we'll move on to go ahead and straight to slide 23. There are four parts of the process that we're going to talk about, and as we tried to show with this graph, this is not an iterative or linear process, but we have to start somewhere. So where we're going to start is with assessing, attracting, and leveraging capital. And that's on slide 24 is where we're going to start the discussion. Actually, let's go to slide 25. I've introduced a new term here, and as essentially I've replaced capital or revenue with capital. When I talked about market-based programs, that was essentially this transition. Capital is a broader term, and it really doesn't matter which one we use right now. But what we're referring to when we say capital, again, we're referring to fiscal resources. But technically, we start to expand the ultimate source of that capital, the source of that revenue. And so it's just to kind of expose you to different terms right now, but really we're going to use them interchangeably. The key points to understand about attracting and leveraging capital, this is the part where we get the money. That's what we're referring to here. And really this is a capacity exercise. So the first thing you have to look at is, all right, you have a watershed protection project that you're trying to do. Let's say you have a stream revitalization or habitat project. The first thing you got to know is, do you have the resources as a community, not just necessarily a local government, but as a community itself, to solve this problem or to finance this problem? So you're kind of looking first what you have. Then you have to evaluate and recommend new revenue sources and capital and revenue approaches. Finally, you need to get everybody engaged in the process. And you're going to see me throw this in many different places. And the key, the bottom line is it has got to be a community process. The most successful projects that we've seen, as we'll talk about later, have been ones that have included a broad number of stakeholder groups and people. So when you're assessing, attracting, and leveraging capital, you got to have everybody engaged. Slide number 26, key issues to consider. Obviously, again, like I said, do you have sufficient levels of revenue to solve the problem? what types of revenue sources are most appropriate, public or private, and are there associated legal barriers. This is, in my opinion, the most politically this is where the real political dynamics come into the financing process. This is where you start to figure out who is going to pay. For example, again, I'm going to refer back to where I live and where I do a lot of my work, which is in the Chesapeake watershed. There is a debate right now happening in the state of Maryland about how to fund Chesapeake Bay-related programs. And the question is, who should pay? How should they pay? What should be the revenue source? How much do we have and how much more are we going to need? We have a budget deficit. What's going to happen? This is the most political part of the process. Even though the types of instruments that are going to be used are critically important, even though the right institutional capacity is going to be important, the issue on everybody's mind is, where's the money going to come from? What's going to be the source of money? This is the big part of the process. So it's, you know, we're kind of, again, doing the financing 101 approach here. I don't mean to belittle how big a part of the process this is or how important this is, but we have to talk about the others. But again, this is really where most of the political debate and a lot of the political dynamics come into play. Slide number 27, we're now going to look at institutional capacity. And again, like I said before, this is often one of the most forgotten about parts of the financing process. Slide number 28, key points in the process. Who has the financing obligation? Is it public or is it private? If it's public, again, you have to go through the discussion. Is it a federal obligation, a state obligation, a local obligation? We are going to talk about, again, a stormwater financing project that's happened, or a program in Montgomery County, Maryland. Most people would agree that stormwater, by definition, is a local financing obligation. I said most people, not all people, and there are some discussions about where state and federal responsibilities come into play. But for the most part, stormwater is considered to be a local government financing obligation. But there are also private obligations as it relates to stormwater. And one of the things that a lot of communities are looking to is in the building and the development process, what responsibility do we have in paying for or financing in the marketplace? So, for example, in new development, we talked about low-impact development tools. If we were to require that or have those incorporated into the development process at the beginning, that's a private financing obligation because the costs associated with those are included in the product itself. Next is the capacity to leverage and allocate resources in place in the community. Let's go back to stormwater. Stormwater really became a critical financing issue, I would argue, after 1987 with the amendments to the Clean Water Act. And one of the first things the communities did was look at when they had a bigger obligation to finance or to implement stormwater programs, specifically now related to water quality. Most communities or many communities looked at their capacity to actually take care of or to meet permitting goals and everything else that goes with stormwater management. It was an institutional analysis. Do we have the programs or the resources in place in the right place in order to accomplish what we need to accomplish? What we found out was, or a lot of communities found out was, they had redundancies. So part of the capacity issue was actually consolidation. And it brought multiple programs or projects into a single place. And so capacity isn't always about getting bigger. Sometimes it's about getting smaller, getting more efficient, getting more streamlined. And again, with stormwater, that was critically important. Slide number 29, key points in the process. If institutional capacity is lacking, where do the breakdowns occur? The Kekapan watershed that we're going to talk about in a minute, in a very rural part of the country, there was not the capacity at the public level to do what needed to be done when it comes to land protection. So a private institution had to step in and fill that capacity issue. So where it's lacking, you have to figure out why it's lacking and what the most appropriate role is, obviously, for different institutions. And then how can it be strengthened? If new institutions are needed, you go through the process of developing them. Sometimes, like I said, it's a matter of consolidation. In the Kekapan, it required a new institution in the form of a land trust to actually accomplish what they were trying to accomplish. Slide number 30. The next step is evaluating and adjusting the regulatory framework. Now, this is a new concept, kind of throwing at everybody here, and I suppose we could have talked about regulation is a key component of financing. But we didn't for several reasons, primarily because there are types of financing, specifically in the private sector, that don't require a regulatory framework. But this is a critically important part of natural resource protection and restoration, and a lot of the times it is what these programs are predicated on or serves as the primary framework. So why law and regulation? The primary reason, in my opinion, is that laws and regulations help us as a community to correct failures in the marketplace. For those of you who have never taken an economics class, I encourage you to do so. And a concept that you will hear over and over is called an externality. And I don't mean to go on too much of a digression here, but primarily what we're saying with an externality is if your watershed is degraded or needs to be restored, then that means what we are doing as a community is not being accounted for. The costs associated with protecting and restoring that watershed are not being accounted for. That's an externality. Regulations can help us deal with that by requiring us to do or not to do certain things, and that's really important with financing. The other thing that regulations do is they have a tendency to encourage us to become very innovative. As soon as we're told we have to do something, and it's going to cost money, we have this almost innate ability as a species to figure out how to do it cheaper. And that regulations are really, really helpful at developing that type of efficiency and that type of innovation. And we see it all over our communities. We see it in all kinds of issues, not just environmental. Anywhere where there's a regulatory compliance is necessary, you will see innovation start to happen. Slide number 32, key issues and questions to consider. First, are regulations even necessary? I will admit that often regulations are a knee-jerk reaction to a problem, and we don't often look at where there may be more efficient or appropriate solutions to a problem. So the first thing is to understand, is it really necessary? If that externality or market breakdown is happening, are there other tools that would be more appropriate and more efficient and cost-effective to implement other than regulations? If regulations are appropriate and are necessary, who has the regulatory responsibility? When I said this, the debate over where the sources of revenue should come from, i.e. the taxes, fees, things like that, being the most politically hot, this is really close. This is number two, and it's right up there with that particular issue. Discussing who has regulatory responsibility is really, really delicate, and again, a very politically charged issue. But it's really important, and you can probably anticipate what we're going to say as being the most the key barometer about where the regulatory responsibility lies. It's efficiency. Let's go back to stormwater. There are those who would say that states have a financing or a regulatory obligation when it comes to stormwater. I would happen to agree, because the broader, when you start looking at regulations, a broad scope can often create efficiency, equitability, and other things that create cost effectiveness and, again, efficiency. I don't mean to be redundant, but a state approach there is important. Land use control is often most efficiently regulated at the local level. So it's that the discussion about who has responsibility should be based on issues of efficiency. And finally, you have to understand, will regulation shift costs, and if so, to whom? I should probably say regulations will shift costs. So, for example, if your community has identified, for example, if you have a wastewater treatment plant that's emitting too many nutrients into a watershed, one way of dealing with the problem is to regulate them and say, you can't do that anymore. And if you regulate them, then that means the community government or local government doesn't have to pay for cleaning up that water body. However, the people in that community do have to pay. And so this cost may shift around in the discussion or the figuring out where those costs shift to. Ultimately, who will be the source of the financing, again, becomes critically important. So it may remove the direct cost from one institution or one level of government or part of the community to another, but has not removed the cost. They are still there. They're just the responsibility of somebody else. Slide number 33. This fourth part of the process is what most of us who do financing prefer to focus on, because this is where it's actually fun. So here you have the revenue in place, you have the right regulatory framework, your institutional capacity there, Now let's start spending money. That's usually the easier part of the process once you've gotten to there. Slide number 34, key issues to consider. Really, what I'm talking about here and the reason why we added this part of the process in place, because this is where communities often get through those other parts of the process and then things break down because they're not looking at efficiency or cost effectiveness when they implement programs. What we're saying here is to focus on performance, not specifically on programs. A lot of the work that I do is related to water quality, which is obviously just a component of watershed protection, but often a very critical component of watershed protection. We have a tendency, this is not unique to any community or watershed in the country, but we have a tendency to focus on programs and established programs as opposed to what specifically works the best as opposed to performance. What we're suggesting is if you focus on performance, you will reduce cost. So basically, it's a dollar per whatever it is that you're trying to accomplish. That should be the metric that you're using for the most part. Invest in future success. I'm kind of pitching particular issues that I think are important for the spending of the money. We often try not to spend too much time talking about how money should be spent, but in some ways it's important from an investment point of view, which is invest in information, research, and monitoring. We had a question about what is a university's role in the financing process. This is where universities can play a real role. The more we know about the watersheds themselves, the more we know about the process and the tools and the resources that are going to be necessary to restore and protect watersheds, the less risk there is in the investment process, and when risks go down, costs go down. And so this is from a financing perspective, this is a critically important part of the process. So even a better understanding physically of watersheds, water quality, natural resource protection, means that ultimately we can invest money in a more efficient and effective way. And so there's a real financing component to it. So the third one is invest in incentives. Try to find those tools or those things that create behavior change or create incentives for behavior change. Because ultimately what we're trying to do is change what we're doing as a community that's causing watersheds to be degraded or to not be protected. And so our programs ought to be focused on creating the right incentives, whether they're fiscal, emotional, whatever they are. We have to invest in those programs that are actually going to correct the problem in the long term. And then finally, coordinate with other community programs and priorities. When we talk about the Cape and Watershed, one of the things that the Land Trust did very effectively was identify where multiple community priorities were and look for ways to achieve them with single programs. So, for example, land protection and watershed protection. Those are two very different things, but the organization was able to couple those two issues together and were able to identify key projects and lands that needed protection because they were looking at key or multiple community priorities and identifying ways of achieving them. They did it very, very effectively. Slide 35. So that's kind of a summary of the financing process. Again, it's not linear. I would say that most communities do start by looking at where's the money going to come from. Unfortunately, that's often where they stop. But all of these kind of have to work in concert with each other. All of them are critically important. And I think now we'll take some more questions.
Thanks, Dan. We will now pause for a few questions. Let's begin with those submitted online. And just as a reminder, you can submit questions online at any time by clicking on the question mark button at the top of the slides page. First, we have a question from Joe in Jefferson City, Missouri. And he asks, Dan, do you include potential in-kind services provided by volunteer organizations in a calculation of capital resources?
It would not be, labor is not a capital resource. In short, the answer is yes. If you're a community organization and you have free labor, that is a reduction in cost. And so you often, especially if you're talking about grant programs, you have to account for that and you have to show that, and that actually adds to the bottom line, or to be technical about it, subtracts from the bottom line, which is a good thing. By the way, I'm going to go all the way back to the very beginning, and you'll understand why I'm going to do that with this question in a second. Again, the goal of financing is to maximize value. In the private sector, maximizing value means one thing, more money. So, for example, when you're financing, you're looking for a return, which means more money. In the public sector, we're really not supposed to do that. That has a tendency to get public officials in trouble. In the public sector, maximizing return almost always means reducing costs. So if part of your cost reduction is voluntary labor, then it's a very good tool. It is a financing tool. And I would imagine, especially with a lot of community-based programs, is a really important tool. For a lot of reasons other than cost reduction, by the way. Remember we said getting community involved, that's a very good way of doing it. Then you can hit them up for another tax and they'll understand it a little bit better at that point. So.
Okay, thanks, Dan. Another question we have is from Carolyn in Kamula, Hawaii. We live on the island of Hawaii, she says, and we currently have a 319 project. And she asks if you have any ideas on how to generate funding in a community with a total population of about 165,000 people and with 41% of them living below poverty.
That sounds like a pretty complex problem, and I might need to actually come out there and help you figure out how to solve it. I have to be honest with you. I would encourage you to send me an email. And I think that your answer is complex enough that it would take a lot of time to answer appropriately in a way that would provide you with any utility. So if you could send me an email, I'd be happy to either have an exchange of emails with you or we can even arrange for a time to talk. So I don't mean to push you off, but I think that would be more effective. So.
Okay, thank you. Another question we have is from Rocky in D.C., and she asks, is there an adequate process or approach for determining how to allocate revenue for various watershed restoration efforts, such as applying wastewater fees for agriculture?
The process for prioritizing and determining what should be financed is going to be dependent on the watershed itself, and the process is unique as the watershed itself. So, for example, the Catapan watershed in West Virginia that we're going to talk about, this organization, as we're going to show, went through a process to prioritize restoration efforts in their watershed, and they were able to use that process to identify critical lands that they wanted to protect. If you're talking about a water quality project, clearly, so for example, if you have a eutrophication problem in your watershed, the areas that you are probably going to focus on are those that you get the greatest return, so dollars per pound of nitrogen, phosphorus, or sediment removed. The one that has the lowest cost would be the ones that you would go for. I would, you know, I do financing. I always look at things from the term of efficiency. One of the things that we assumed in this process, by the way, in this discussion, is that there are watershed protection plans in place. We could probably add another bubble to the process and say having an understanding of what you're trying to finance is clearly very important. But it's important for several reasons. One is that often communities go through the watershed planning process without an understanding of what their capacity is going to be to finance, and we would recommend that financing work its way into the process at the very beginning. So I don't mean to punt the issue. I'm just suggesting that it's going to depend on the watershed itself and then where you see the priorities in your watershed protection strategy.
Thanks, Dan. We have a question also online from Elliot in Richland County in South Carolina. And he asks, what suggestions do you have for engaging multiple municipalities, both large and small, around a watershed issue that affects them all? So how do you deal with a watershed that's got a lot of municipalities? How do you get them all together?
Hi, this is Tim. I think one way to get them all engaged is to try to focus on a problem that would is at the local level, and that they could all see a benefit from. I think that would be one way to try to get people to focus together on a common, you know, joining together and working together. And Dan, if you know.
Financing is often very difficult to do in multiple jurisdictions, though we should also say multiple institutions. Watershed or water quality financing often happens outside of government or traditional government frameworks. So, for example, large utilities often cross over different jurisdictions. So if you live in a community that, for example, has the ability to have authorities or utilities that cross over jurisdictional lines, that is one opportunity as it relates to financing. But it is often very difficult. There are certain tools and instruments that cannot be used across different jurisdictions. So perhaps the most important thing is what Tim just said, which is some type of communication or understanding of where there are common problems and opportunities for solving those problems. And even though the financing process itself might be implemented individually or within specific communities, coordinating that process can be very important. Again, I will come back to where we are, the Chesapeake Bay watershed. The restoration in the Chesapeake Bay watershed has been predicated on that type of coordination and cooperation among not just different states, but different local governments.
At this time, if anyone would like to answer a question over the phone, please unmute yourself and give us your name and organization before your question. Any questions?
Yes. Hello, this is Brad in Region 6.
Yes.
I have a question.
Yes. Go ahead.
Okay. I was wondering if there is a higher success rate for obtaining private financing if you have a watershed plan developed. Much like a bank would require of a new company that is seeking financing, they would have to have an investment plan. What kind of level of detail, too, would they be looking for in a watershed plan to attain that private financing? I'll hang up and listen.
Your question is infinitely more complex by inserting the word private when you start talking about money or private revenue or private investment. Private investors are going to be looking for a fiscal return on their money. So your watershed protection plan, if you're talking about acquiring private revenue or private resources, dollars, is going to have to provide some opportunity for those investors to make a return on their money. And they have different tools and metrics that they're going to use to gauge what that opportunity is. That said, if you're looking at the innovative ways for attracting capital, the most important thing you can have is a plan and an understanding of the resource itself and where you have identified the priorities within your watershed, and then a specific understanding of the cost associated with what you're trying to accomplish. Now, this doesn't mean you have to get down to every dollar or that level of detail, but you have to have a real understanding of scale and exactly of what's going to be accomplished. You also need to be able to show that you have the communities engaged and ready to participate. In other words, you have the opportunity for success. That's going to be critically important. Again, when we talk about the Kekapin watershed, they were actually able to attract capital and revenue because they had a plan in place and they had the community backing the plan. And specifically, we're looking at here land protection. They had landowners lining up to actually participate in easement programs, and that sent a strong signal to the funders that they had an opportunity to be successful. Again, the issue of private capital or private revenue in investment implies a fiscal return, and so that is a bit more complex, but the bottom line is there is that they're going to need to see an opportunity for getting a return on that money.
Thanks, Dan. I'd just add that some of the national estuary programs, they all have comprehensive plans that they developed over a 2 to 3 to 4 year time period, and with the buy-in and involvement of all the sectors in the society and the community, and as a result of that buy-in, people are more willing to come to the table with their resources because they have been part of developing the plan, and I think that builds the trust and credibility that you need in order to convince people that, you know, what you'll do with your resources will be well spent, and also that you'll get some credit for your contribution. So I think it's like both the plan, a long-range plan with a lot of involvement, and then long-range lifespan of the organization, so you can build that trust and credibility over time.
Thank you, Tim and Dan. We are also hearing from another person in Kansas who is saying that they appreciated the question from Hawaii about funding in an area with a large amount of population living at or below the poverty level. They say that this is also a problem in Kansas as well as in many other places, and one that they would like to hear the answer to at some point.
Yeah, well, I think that means that I'm not going to be allowed to punt and say you can send me an email also. You know, one of the things that is inherent about financing environmental protection is that the tools that we use or that we propose to use are often regressive. And what we mean by that is they impact poorer communities relatively more than they impact wealthier communities. And that is a real problem that we face, not just in watershed protection, but all across the environmental spectrum. I would also point out, however, that we have tools in place throughout our society and our community to provide subsidies to those communities that are needing them. So we know how to do this at the public level specifically. The bottom line is the entire community is going to have will benefit from watershed protection, water quality protection, the other land protection, the things that go into watershed protection and restoration. Therefore, you need to leverage the resources of the entire community. If you are trying to finance a project in a community that is disadvantaged economically, by definition, the revenue is going to have to come from other places. And I know that I'm not getting real specific, and I know that a lot of you would like specific examples, and we've seen them. For example, we've seen communities propose that have a septic problem or an on-site system where new development, in order to come in, has to pay to upgrade or deal with a water quality problem in existing communities that don't have the resources themselves to pay for it. So you're basically saying if you want to build a new community here in this watershed, you're going to help us pay for some of the problems we have, especially in those communities that don't have the money. So there's innovative programs like that. And by the way, the community that I'm referring to, it was the builder that recommended this program just to get the community in place. And so it's not always draconian in its implementation. There are also a lot of state and federal programs, obviously, that can help defray some of the costs, and I know I'm totally contradicting myself when I say that. But that, by the way, is an appropriate use of those types of resources. I know, again, it sounds like I'm punting here, but I would have to say that these types of issues are as unique as the communities and the watersheds themselves, but there are resources, there are tools, and there are techniques and processes that you can go through to help deal with some of these issues, but it's not easy. It's like anything else in our society. It's really hard to redistribute revenue and resources in an effective way.
Thanks, Dan. I would just add that there's a couple of programs that come to mind. One is the Rensselaerville STEP program. I think it stands for Small Town Environmental Program. And they have a strategy that they lay out, which involves smart engineering, use of volunteers, and community leaders to reduce the costs involved in environmental restoration first, and then to use local resources, your community, to tackle some of the problems. So that's actually the main point I had. And we could try to add that as a resource when we put out the rebroadcast or have it on the website.
Okay, thanks, Dan. And these are complex questions. I'm going to now move on to the rest of the presentation. As we move on, please move to slide 37. I'd like to take just one moment here to tell you about our next webcast. The Watershed Academy webcast team will sponsor its 28th free seminar on November 28th. I don't know if we could get those the numbers to align like that very often. So remember, November 28th. This webcast will highlight smart growth issues. And if you're interested in that, please visit the Watershed Academy webcast page at www.epa.gov/watershedwebcast for more information. Now back to Dan for the rest of the presentation and examples that he's going to provide.
Okay, directly to slide 39. We're going to talk about two communities, and I got to tell you right now that the two questions about disenfranchised communities are now going to stick with me, and I'm sure I'm going to end up trying to answer them again. So you guys tripped me up on that one. I appreciate that. But slide 39, we're looking at three kind of key characteristics of effective watershed financing processes or in communities that we've seen across the country. The first is, we keep saying this, they're community-based, multiple stakeholder groups. Again, when you're spending people's money and you're taking people's money, you ought to have them engaged. It'll make the process a whole lot easier. The programs that we've seen that have been really effective, and I think the CACAPIN example we're going to talk about in a minute is really indicative of this, are really diverse. They integrate multiple funding sources, multiple institutions. They have tremendous leadership that is relentless in identifying kind of a patchwork approach to their financing process, and it's very, very effective. You know, watersheds are incorporate a lot of different things in the community, and the financing should also. They kind of incorporate, as we say here, multiple landowners, multiple land uses, landscapes, and all the things that go with that. So this doesn't sound very technical or very finance-based, but these are the three things that we've seen that are common to all the programs. Slide number 40. We're going to look at two case studies. It's no coincidence that they're both located in the Mid-Atlantic region. This is where I'm from and where I do a lot of my work. But my guess is they're not unique, and there are similar examples all across the country, if not the world. But we're going to talk about two specifically. The first is the CACAPIN and Lost Rivers Land Trust in West Virginia. And specifically, we're going to be looking at how they financed a very aggressive land protection strategy. And then the second one is Montgomery County, Maryland, and looking at their stormwater management plan, which is probably similar to hundreds of others across the country, but provides a really good example of how this watershed priority or issue is being financed in communities all around the country. Slide number 41, we're going to look at both of these case studies using the same criteria. The first is, how were they able to attract, and maybe, I'm not sure developing revenue sources is appropriate, but attracting and leveraging and applying revenue sources. Second, looking at institutional capacity, understanding where there were deficiencies and what was the most appropriate way to build on the existing capacity. Third, the role of regulations. Sometimes in one case study, it was not as important as it was in the other. Obviously, stormwater regulations have played a significant role. And then finally, what were the investment strategies, and how did these two communities actually put the money on the ground in the most efficient way possible? The CACAPIN, slide number 42, the CACAPIN and Lost Rivers Watershed in West Virginia. Let me start by saying West Virginia is not a wealthy state. So this is directly for our participant in Hawaii. We are dealing with a community here that's rural. It is not does not have a very high per capita income, yet they are able to do some very amazing things with financing. And so hopefully this provides an example. I'm, again, not exactly sure what you're dealing with, but this is an example of one community that was able to deal with this issue or this dynamic very effectively. The CACAPIN and Lost Rivers are actually one river. They flow, if you look at that map there, they flow south to north. It's the Lost River in the south. It's called that because in dry months it disappears into a karst topography and then reappears as the CACAPIN. And it is a tributary of the Potomac River, which ends up flowing into the Chesapeake, which you can see is that big blue stripe going off to the right-hand side of the map. 625-square-mile watershed. It is located entirely in the state of West Virginia in Hampshire, Hardy, and Morgan counties. It is actually one of the, it is a very undisturbed, relatively undisturbed watershed in the Washington, D.C., Baltimore area. And I say relatively undisturbed because we're in a very urban environment here. So having, if there are any of you who are calling from very rural areas in the West, if you were to come here, you might not think that it was pristine. But for those of us who are here, it pretty much is. Slide number 43. However, even though it is relatively pristine, it has pressures. This is a very mountainous state, and so much of the agriculture that happens in the state happens in river valleys, specifically right on the river's edge. And so as a result of animal production, there are bacterial contamination problems in the river, and it actually has been listed for that. It is also experiencing significant development pressure, specifically from the Washington, D.C. and Baltimore areas. For example, after 9/11, you can imagine people in this area were a little bit concerned after that, and there was a spike in second home sales for people who were looking for an escape route in case the big one hit. And so very quickly, over the last 5 or 6 years, we've seen rapid development happen in parts of this watershed. And then the third major stressor was a new highway that crossed the watershed. That's that purple line that you're looking there. It goes east to west, and it bisects this river in 11 different places. So the highway itself has had an ecological impact, but what highways bring, i.e. growth, development, those types of things, is also going to have an impact, and this was a real motivating factor for the Land Trust. Slide number 44, the Land Trust was established in 1995. It was established by local landowners who were concerned about the watershed and the quality of life, and kind of the rural heritage and what this river and the watershed meant to their community. What you don't see on here are some of the statistics. The Land Trust had about 500 acres under easement 6 years ago. They now have almost 9,000 acres under easement, another 1,000 acres that will be eased very quickly, and about 15,000 acres that are in the pipeline, i.e. those are landowners who have shown an interest, and the Land Trust is looking for the resources to get that land permanently protected. So this is a very successful organization that's moving very, very quickly to start trying to deal with some of their problems. In 2002, this is where, when we talked about you need a, you know, we're assuming that you have a plan in place that you're trying to finance, this event, Healing Waters, by the way, Kekapin means healing waters in the Native American language of that area. This is where they developed their plan, and they had resource experts from all across the country come in and work with them to identify those areas in the watershed that from an ecological point of view and from a heritage point of view were most critical to protect. And then they followed that up with a financing charrette to take that plan and say, okay, how are we going to prioritize financially to figure out where we should protect and how we should move forward? And then they followed that up with another meeting to specifically figure out how they were going to get this on the ground. So that, this is important because, again, this is a process. Financing is a process. It doesn't happen overnight, especially something as complex as watersheds. And this group went through a very detailed, structured process to figure out exactly what they needed to finance, what the cost associated with the problem was, and then what resources they had available and what their strategy for bringing resources into the watershed was going to be. Slide number 45, the trust set a goal of raising $200,000 annually by 2010. That is a very aggressive fundraising goal. This is a land trust that has one paid staff person who wasn't even getting paid until a couple of years ago, who worked primarily on a project-by-project basis in its financing, identifying large properties that need to be protected, finding the financing to get that property protected. And so identifying annual revenue streams is a very difficult thing to do, but it's critically important. When we started talking about things that, you know, we started looking at things like debt, and when we're dealing with land protection, that's often what we're talking about. Having annual revenue streams is really, really important. But also from an organizational point of view, for those of you who are calling in from a nonprofit or a private sector institution, you know how important it is to have consistent revenue coming in just so you can do what it is that you do. So there's a reason why I added this case study in here is because I know a lot of you are calling from these types of institutions, and this is a very difficult thing to do. And so they really need a structure for how they're going to do that. And one of the ways is to be more diverse in their type of funding. They have relied exclusively, especially for the support of the organization, exclusively on grants. and they realize they can't do that any longer. For one thing, the executive director, who's really good at financing land protection deals, was spending her time writing grant proposals, and it was not a very efficient use of her time. But they also knew that that just was not a sustainable approach. If you were having a hard time finding certain grants over the last several years, I think part of the problem might have been they were all going into this watershed. She was really successful at getting grant money to come in, but she realized she couldn't rely on that any longer. Considered a lot of cost-reducing measures. This primarily was a very detailed GIS-based evaluation of particular properties and understanding where their biggest bang for the buck was when it came to land protection. So, for example, connecting state and federal protected areas, that was the most cost-effective approach because obviously they didn't have to do anything there. So creating hubs and corridors, they were able to actually reduce their total land protection needs to a few properties, certainly in the short term, that would have the greatest impact on the watershed. So it significantly reduced costs. Again, identifying sustainable revenue streams, easier said than done, but they're going through a process of doing that. Examining market-based opportunities. I would argue that all land trusts are developed based on market-based programs and opportunities. Easements, and I'm not sure if everybody's familiar with an easement, but basically all an easement is the landowner gives away their right to do certain things on the land, and those rights are removed and codified in the deed, so it's forever. That's market-based. There's nothing requiring these landowners to do that. Sometimes easements are the result of regulation. So, for example, if your community is running a new water line, they might ease property that says we have the right to come on there and maintain lines or something like that. But for when we're talking about land protection, this is a market-based program. Sometimes landowners do it for fiscal reasons, i.e. they get tax breaks when you actually give away development rights, you get tax credits for that. But for the most part, this land trust has relied on voluntary easements, and those are usually done for altruistic reasons. These people wanted to protect their land for future generations. But again, it's a market-based tool. And then effectively developing institutional relationships. This was really important for this small land trust. They partnered with larger land trusts. They gave them the ability to monitor and to enforce and to back up what they were doing. Very, very important. And if they weren't able to do that, they would not have the capacity to actually accomplish what they were trying to accomplish from a financing perspective. Working directly with state agencies, they've been very effective at doing that. And so the state's institutional capacity, actually, I would argue, was increased almost as much as this organization's capacity was increased by working with the states. But that symbiotic relationship has been very important. Slide number 46. Diversifying funding sources. This is kind of the hedge funding approach to watershed protection. You're trying to remove spikes, quick gains and quick declines. That's what hedging does. And this is really important for this organization because this allows you to take a long-term vision of what you're trying to accomplish. And so what this usually means is diversifying many different tools. Let's just assume, even if you decide after this presentation, you know what, we're still going to go out and hire a grant writer because we think that's the most important thing. Even diversifying your grant writing and your grant funding is a really good first step. So, you know, don't rely on just a 319 grant. Try to look into some other places. Diversifying funding also allowed organizational stability. And so, again, a land trust has to be, well, by the way, land trusts are different than any other nonprofit in that by definition, they have to be in existence in perpetuity. When a land is eased, it's eased forever, and these land trusts need to be there. And so having organizational stability is really important. And then the other thing is that by removing these peaks and valleys, quick gains and declines, you're able to ride out different dynamics in budgeting processes, specifically at the government level. But when funding priorities or things like that change, market conditions, you're able to ride some of those things out. I know a lot of you are thinking, yeah, this all sounds great. How am I supposed to do that? And I admit it's not easy to do, but this is the direction that you should be going when you're looking at these issues, and we'll explain a little bit about how they were able to do that now on slide 47. Another, by the way, thing they're looking at, let's go to the cost-reducing measures. Collaboration was number one. By far, this helped this organization reduce its costs. they partnered with a very large land trust that ironically was not nearly as effective at protecting land, specifically in this watershed, but had institutional capacity to back them up. That reduced the cost to the Catapan Land Trust significantly. By the way, I'm going to shorten it to the Catapan Land Trust because I will inevitably call it the Catapan and Lost Livers Land Trust. So to keep from doing that, we'll call it the Catapan Land Trust. So the collaboration literally had a bottom line effect. This goes back to the person's question about volunteers being a revenue tool. This was a real revenue tool for this institution. Looking at regulation, this is a debate that goes on a lot in land trust specifically. Should we be pushing local communities to get more aggressive on regulatory controls, specifically zoning? You know, you hear a lot of people say zoning does not protect land, but it does help shift community priorities and lead to land use decisions that may be more sustainable. And so it is also a way for the organization to reduce its costs because it may not need to ease by development rights or things like that in particular areas because the zoning and the regulations are most appropriate. And then finally, leveraging community priorities. One of the really important things in this watershed is their heritage, and agriculture has been a core part of this community's heritage for generations. A lot of the organization's mission is focused on water quality, but they were able to convince a lot of farmers to protect their land and then able to get particular best management practices related to water quality as part of the easement process. And so they were able to couple two very important community priorities and ultimately reduce the cost. If you tried to approach both of those, for example, having one watershed organization focusing on water quality and the land trust just focusing on agricultural protection, it would have been more expensive. And bringing all that stuff together in one place led to a lot of efficiency. Slide number 48. Identifying sustainable revenue streams. This is as unique as the organization and the watershed. In this watershed, they have one of the most popular camps, youth camps in the country. And a lot of the young people that go to this camp are from families that have means, financial means. And the organization is looking to going to those people to help protect this watershed. So who's the financing source? Very private. It's actually the individuals who are coming into the watershed. And I don't know, again, going back to the question from Hawaii, what your community is like, but if there's opportunity to leverage revenue from people who are coming into your community to use the resources, that would be at the top of my list of priorities, and that's what this organization is looking to do. Management and monitoring fees. Again, this organization is on the ground in this watershed, and they're able to do certain things that might be the priority of other institutions, and they are possibly able to get resources to help support their activities in these areas. Mitigation monies. Corridor 8, that highway going across the watershed, whether or not the community agreed with the highway coming in, lots of people did, lots of people didn't, this organization saw an opportunity once the decision was made to build the highway, and they were able to use mitigation money from the state to protect thousands of acres of farmland in important resource areas in this watershed. And so it was a major, major financing tool that they were able to take advantage of. A major donor campaign. I'm not going to spend too much time talking about this because everybody wants to have a major donor campaign. Easier said than done, but they're really trying to figure out how to do this, how to find, how to sell their watershed and their institution to those people with the resources. And then finally, state and federal funds. I would not recommend making this the foundation of your financing plan, but it can be a very important part of it. And this organization, like many others, is going to do everything they can to leverage state and federal funds. It's very appropriate when you look at it in concert with all of these other things that they're looking at. Slide number 49, examining market-based programs. Again, development rights programs, by definition, are market-based. For the most part, they have voluntary easements, but they're also moving into purchasing development rights, which is going to a landowner and saying, we'll pay you to give up your right to develop. It's a big step for a lot of land trusts, but it can be very effective. There are other communities, by the way, that are able to do things like transferring development rights. And there are Montgomery County, Maryland. We're going to talk about their stormwater program. They're also held up as a national example of how a transfer of development rights program can work effectively. And the county was able to protect about 35,000 square miles acres of protected land right in the center of the county, agricultural land. Very, very effective program. And then tourism. The Kekapan, again, is a pristine watershed. It's actually a very popular canoeing and kayaking area, at least in the spring until the river disappears. But they are talking about how they can use tourism to actually help support land protection activities in the watershed, specifically their organization. Slide 50. So let's look at the four criteria. Revenue. Clearly a plan for diversifying, and I would argue they've been very diversified over the years, especially when you look at the mitigation money that they've used. There have been a couple of financing projects, land protection projects, one specifically that protected 4,000 acres of farmland and had five or six different financing resources and tools. They were all brought together in one place. Very complex, but very, very effective. Institutional capacity. This is a critical issue for the community because this organization is serving, is providing institutional capacity that it would not have otherwise. And so from the community's perspective, this organization is critical. From the organization's perspective, its own capacity is also critical, a constant topic of discussion, critical need, and so the institutional issue goes both ways, both internally and externally. Regulatory framework. You know, the organization is working with agencies to look at regulation, but for the most part, their regulatory approach is, for example, the mitigation money. That was a requirement under state and federal law that the state mitigate the impact of that highway, and they were able to take advantage of that. This organization, for the most part, has chosen not to get aggressive in pushing local regulation and land use protection from a regulatory perspective. That's the decision that it made, and so it's trying to work around that particular component of the financing process. Investment, they were looking at bang for the buck, and that the Healing Waters Project and the process of identifying key protection areas reduced their costs. This organization will never be able to protect the entire watershed. It's never going to be able to ease every acre within this watershed. And so prioritizing ultimately reduced the costs associated with what they were trying to accomplish. So prioritization and land preservation was the key issue. We're now going to move on to a totally different issue, which is stormwater protection. And really what we're doing is moving from a very rural issue and watershed protection priority and need to a very urban watershed protection priority and need. And we're going to look at Montgomery County, Maryland. Slide number 52, you'll see a map. I'm not sure how well the colors are coming through here, but in the center of that map, about two-thirds of the way up, you will see a pink county called Montgomery County. It is a suburb of Washington, D.C., which is that almost square-looking jurisdiction just below it. Slide number 53, again, just north of Washington, has a total population of about 1 million and growing. Washington is a relatively fast-growing metropolitan area. It is very affluent, very urban. I should say, however, clarify that like any community that is the size of Montgomery County, on average it's very affluent, but not everybody is, and there are pockets in this community that are quite the opposite, and they are incorporated into the financing process too. So I will be the first to admit that having means as a community in general provides a lot of financing opportunity, but not everybody in the community has means, and we'll talk about that in a minute. And by definition, they have lots of urban stormwater runoff. We're going to talk a lot about the law that has impacted stormwater, but the community this size, basically, they were one of the first that had to implement stormwater management planning, and they were one of the first communities of this size that were the first to actually put the financing tools in place. Slide number 54. Stormwater utilities, I just want to have a little bit of a primer on this before we move forward. When I refer to a utility, I'm talking about an enterprise that was developed specifically to support urban stormwater programs. We're talking about the stormwater equivalent of a wastewater or a drinking water utility, and there are many of these across the country, about 500 or so, as you see on that last bullet point, that exist across the United States and is growing all the time. Primarily, they resulted from the passage of the 1987 Water Quality Act, which were the amendments to the Clean Water Act. but not exclusively. There have been stormwater utilities in existence since the 70s. So obviously there are other things motivating communities to finance stormwater management. Flooding was often the primary reason why they did this, but often other issues like water quality or habitat protection. So we saw there were a few communities and states that had stormwater utilities, but for the most part, the relative, I would say exponential growth, the implementation of this financing tool has been the result of the amendments to the Clean Water Act in 1987. And basically what that meant was stormwater was now going to be managed as a point source, i.e. it was permitted. So these communities had to get a permit for managing stormwater, which means there are certain things they were now going to be required to do, and that was going to require money. Slide number 55. Montgomery County had multiple program goals. The first was they were permitted, and the permitting program is under the NPDES permitting program, but specifically it's called an MS4, Municipally Separate Sewer Storm Systems. So don't get all hung up on the acronyms here, but basically there were two types of communities, Phase 1 and Phase 2. And Phase 1 just meant you're big, 500,000 people or more. And they were the first ones to get permitted. So Montgomery County clearly is a Phase 1. So they now had a permit obligation, and they needed to figure out how they were going to finance those obligations. They also wanted to create efficiencies and, again, reduce redundancies in their own stormwater programs. And so in some ways, this goes beyond regulatory pressure, and this just gets to the need or the desire to spend public resources more efficiently, and that's what was pushing this issue. And then finally was to establish and maintain fiscal capacity. Specifically, they looked at the operation maintenance of their stormwater program, and they wanted to have a codified, dedicated, sustainable financing or revenue stream that was going to help support their program. So those were their three primary goals. That is not unique to Montgomery County, Maryland, and I would argue that if you did a case study on just about all of the stormwater programs across the country, these three things are going to show up in there someplace. Slide number 56, the revenue source. What happened when you have a stormwater utility, by definition, two things are happening. The first is the responsibility for stormwater management is coming into a single place or a single enterprise, but then you also usually have the opportunity to raise revenue through fees. And that's what Montgomery County was doing. So everybody in Montgomery County pays a stormwater fee. It's actually technically a tax because it's located and collected off the tax bills in the county. But it is, we're going to call it a fee, just because everybody else does. Everybody in the county pays for it. Nobody is exempt. This is why it is a fee because if you're a church, you have to pay for it. So even those institutions that are not taxed pay this fee. So even though it shows up on tax bills, obviously if you're a church, you don't get a tax bill, or another institution that's not taxed. They have other ways of getting you. But everybody has to pay it. And this is why when we go back to talking about what revenue source is most appropriate, this community realized that even tax-exempt institutions were contributing to stormwater problems and had an obligation to pay for the solution to those problems, so a fee-based system made more sense to them than a tax-based system. And there are many communities across the country who've made the opposite decision and have decided to use tax revenue and therefore are not able to get at that problem or have decided that it wasn't necessary. And again, revenue is collected as part of the property tax bill. Slide number 57. The rate is based on what's called an equivalent dwelling unit, and the only thing you need to remember with that is it's an average. That's the average size. And so this was the EDU just means here's the average that we're going to charge across the county, and it's based on the average size of a home. And the average size of a home in Montgomery County or footprint is 2,400 square feet. You can decide if you think that's a lot or a little or average. But in Montgomery County, it's 2,400 square feet is the equivalent dwelling unit. And that means if you have a home that is bigger than that, you pay more. And if you have a home that is smaller than that, you would pay a fraction of one EDU. But it's all based on that particular square footage. The rate is established annually. And actually, in Montgomery County, the original fee was about $12 per year, and it has gone up as the county council has looked at the needs of the system. They have increased the program. The current rate is about $25 per EDU. So on average, a household in Montgomery County pays $25 per year By the way, I should have added a slash per year after that EDU. That is $25 per year. That is actually less than what we have seen nationally. If you look at all the stormwater programs across the country, the average fee is about $4 to $5 per month. Quite honestly, that number is driven by political palatability or political will. It is not driven by the needs of the programs themselves. And what we're starting to see are stormwater programs that are lacking resources because they collected the revenue that they thought they could collect as opposed to saying this is how much we need to support this program and pushing it through at that level. It's an understandable way to approach it. We do this all the time, but we're starting to see the impacts of that right now. Slide number 58, institutional structure. The county established a new institution to manage the stormwater programs. I should say sort of. It is managed within their Department of Environment that has always existed, but they developed a new program or part of the agency within the Department of the Environment. But what they really did was reduce redundant programs, and this we see all across communities, that stormwater management or the passage of the 1987 Water Quality Act led to real efficiencies because you see in communities all the time, and by the way, you see it in other places too, like with restoration, habitat, stream restoration, multiple programs or agencies are doing the same thing just for different reasons. So, for example, the Parks Department might be doing stormwater management projects to protect natural resources within parks, and at the same time, you could have the same type of thing going on with the highways or the road construction group. And what they realized was all of that should be brought into one place. That reduced redundancies. Probably reduced staff. Somebody probably didn't like the fact that they were reducing these redundancies, but it did save the community money and created a lot of efficiency. And then finally, this program focuses on operations and maintenance of the system. You need to remember that financing is as unique as the communities that's doing the financing. Montgomery County, Maryland decided that only the operations and maintenance needed to be paid for out of this fee that they collect. If they needed to pour concrete or do some type of capital infrastructure improvement, build something, they needed to have debt financing. That is done through the county's general fund. And by general fund, we're referring to the primary tax revenue that comes in. They still finance through the capital infrastructure through their general fund. That is the way that most stormwater programs function. More than 85% of stormwater programs finance capital infrastructure improvements through general fund or through some other fund other than the fee that they are collecting. The primary reason for doing this is because the political will issue we talked about. If you're only going to collect $4 or $5, but your costs are $10 to $15 per household per month, that money's got to come from somewhere. I would argue that a lot of communities, though, like Montgomery County, made that decision because of efficiency and effectiveness. They feel like they can be more effective in their financing if they do it this way, and every community should have a right to determine that for themselves. Slide number 59. And I can almost anticipate where some of the questions are going to be coming from now, and that probably is one place, if not a question, certainly some comments. 59, regulatory framework. Stormwater is now regulated, and as a result, we have permitting programs. Now, I know that regulation is not the only reason why communities have decided to finance stormwater, but it sure has not hurt. And what we have seen since 1987 and really since the enforcement of Phase 1 and now Phase 2 of the MS4 permitting process, all of a sudden stormwater utilities started to jump up or to pop up. And so the regulatory framework was critically important for this particular watershed protection activity. One of the real problems that we face with protecting and financing watershed protection is we don't have very many regulations in place to help us do it. And so we have to have some other means for motivating people to do what needs to be done. Again, Montgomery County is a Phase 1 community under the MS4 permitting program, and it's enforced by the state, which means they've got to do it. They've got to get it done. Slide number 60. Again, the program pays for the maintenance of stormwater facilities. So their investment strategy, quite honestly, is simple. Inspection, construction, limited construction and reconstruction, as long as it fits within their budget that they collect with their $25 per EDU. And then modifications to the system. Again, any large-scale infrastructure improvements are financed in another way. Financing tools, they don't really have any. Their financing tool is pay as you go. And this is, again, not unique to this particular community. But they do not, for this particular utility. Now, it's important to say that the financing stormwater management in general in Montgomery County uses a broad variety of financing tools because they're using debt financing through the general fund program. But for this particular utility, it's pay as you go. Slide 61. Back to our four criteria. Their revenue is sustainable. It's dedicated. I did not put sufficient in there, but I would argue it is sufficient based on the goals of the program and the goals of this particular enterprise that they put together and were trying to accomplish. I keep hitting this issue because I paid attention to the debate that went on in Montgomery County with the development of this enterprise fund, and there was a lot of concern specifically by some environmental groups there was a feeling that they should collect the entire cost associated with stormwater management, and that was a debate that happened back and forth. So you will hear some people say Montgomery County, Maryland stormwater program does not, the revenue is not sufficient. I think it's a definitional issue. I would argue that it is. Institutional capacity improved and expanded. They now have the capacity to manage this problem within a single agency. Regulatory framework, I'm going to say it's the foundation of the process, but it's not exclusive. But I really feel like the 1987 law has been critical to getting stormwater financing going and to dealing with this problem in a sustainable way. It's not been sufficient. We need more. A lot of communities still are not taking the steps they need to take or find it very difficult to do that, but it's been a very important first step. This particular program, again, their investment strategy, focus on maintenance. When I say focus on maintenance, I'm not trying to belittle this. We could do an entire another session on the issue of full cost pricing and appropriate financing. Tim mentioned the $600 billion infrastructure gap associated with wastewater and drinking water infrastructure. There is a primary reason why that happened. There are many different reasons, but the primary reason why we have that gap is that wastewater and drinking water systems have not been focusing on the operations and maintenance of their system. And as a result, the systems are decaying and they are falling apart, and to fix them is going to require a lot of money. If we had been paying attention to this problem and financing this problem through the years, we would not have a gap. So having a system like Montgomery County, Maryland, stormwater system that's actually paying for the operations and maintenance of their system is a really important financing issue, because it means that overall their costs will be reduced because they're taking the care of the problem now. It's a full cost pricing of the issue or what they're trying to accomplish. There are few truths in financing, but one of them is it is cheaper to protect than it is to restore. And that goes for infrastructure also. It helps to keep paying as you go, and make sure that you're maintaining things appropriately. So I think I got my point across on that one. Very important to the financing process. Slide 62. Financing, again, is the process for success. This is how we will get watersheds protected and restored. This is what will be required. I know there are a lot of other motivations in our community for protecting natural resources, but for the parts of the process that are going to require us to actually deal with costs, it's the financing process that is going to allow us to do that in the most efficient way possible, and that means we'll actually be successful. If I haven't made the point yet, it requires everybody to participate. That's why it's appropriate for every institution and organization to be participating in this conversation. Because financing, again, is ultimately how we get things done, and that requires everybody. And we've just seen two examples of where that is the case and how important it is that everybody get engaged in the process. And that's it.
Thanks, Dan. We will again have some time for questions. However, let me first draw your attention to where you can obtain both Tim and Dan's contact information. If you're online, you can simply click on the home button at the top of your screen. You'll be returned to the seminar's homepage, which has a speaker's email address and phone number. Now I'm going to ask you to please move to slide number 65. And on the screen here, you'll see the links for additional resources. We will try to add the website that Tim referred to that links page. There's also a link for feedback. For those of you that are participating online, you can take a look at the left-hand sidebar, and there's a links button there as well as a feedback button. And for those of you that are participating by phone, please just use the links that are provided. We're now going to address our audience questions. Let's begin with those submitted online. Tim, there's one question now for you first. Darlene from Asheville, North Carolina, says that she would like to have information on the organization that you talked about in the last session. She's wondering if you can provide that.
Happy to, Darlene. It's called the Small Towns Environment Program, and their website is www.r, as in Roger, Institute, one word, so rinstitute.org/step, S-T-E-P, /step.htm. And just looking quickly at their brochure or their the website, they do show that they've been able to save roughly 50 to 75% on costs for wastewater treatment and drinking water systems by using some of their techniques of volunteer using volunteers, smart tech engineering, and utilizing spark plug folks in the community to make things happen. So I encourage you to check that organization out.
Thanks, Tim. We have a question now from Cheryl from Topeka, Kansas, and she asks, referring to slide 57, does the 2,400 square foot refer to the footprint of the actual dwelling or the entire lot size?
I'm pretty sure it's the dwelling, but I'll clarify that for you. But that's the point of the EDU is looking at the actual impact on the land, footprint on the land, so... pretty sure it's a dwelling.
I think that's a safe bet. I live in Montgomery County, and I think that's correct. I do have $25 charge, and my property can't spill. I can attest to that. Dan, another question for you from Valerie in Michigan. She asks, what are some examples of market-based opportunities for watershed protection organizations other than land trusts?
Well, it will depend on which part of watershed protection that you're looking at. For example, water quality is a major issue in a lot of communities, major issue of concern. And so the market-based program that a lot of people are looking at as being an opportunity is trading or nutrient trading, water quality trading. So that's a big issue, probably more than a particular watershed organization is going to want to take on, but that's an example of it. A lot of the market-based programs are going to require a regulatory approach, and this is where watershed organizations can be very impactful by understanding where regulations are critical and then working with their elected officials to put better regulations in place. Let me give you an example. In the state of Maryland, the state has identified on-site wastewater systems or septics to be a major water quality concern. And part of their water quality strategy is to upgrade 420 to 450,000 systems to the limits of technology at an estimated cost of about $3 billion. I would argue that a more efficient way of approaching this problem would be through some type of regulatory approach where the cost associated with managing wastewater from on-site systems is incorporated into the market, i.e., you require functioning systems every time there is a transaction, though that doesn't get to the entire water quality problem. You could get as aggressive as saying we will not allow traditional systems to be sold in our state any longer, and some people have suggested that. Or it could be as simple as saying you have to, in particular areas that are critical to water quality, there you have to upgrade, but you have to do it through the market process somehow. So basically those are the types of things that are going to be really important. Their market-based tools, again, what we're referring to is incorporating the entire cost into whatever it is that we're doing in our community. For that reason, stormwater programs are a market-based type tool because we're saying that the cost associated with this is going to be accounted for. So it really depends on what issue you're dealing with. And all four of the different things that we looked at can be a tool or a market-based tool that you might want to rely on.
Thanks, Dan. Just one example I thought of is tax incentives, tax credits for septic tank upgrades. That's, a Massachusetts state program that they passed. So it's a market-based mechanism in that it encourages people to do those upgrades, and they get a benefit through their tax reduced taxes.
Okay, thanks to both of you. One last question online. We have a question about the Cacapon watershed. The question, Dan, is the high fecal coliform in the Cacapon due to the manure input from agriculture? And they're also asking, has there been a reduction in fecal levels after the easement acquisition program? And are the easements specifically targeted at areas where there are high concentration of livestock?
A lot of the land trust work has not focused in the southern portion of the watershed as of yet, though they have, I just met with the executive director recently, and she indicated that they're now moving into that area. So the answer to your question is, has there been a direct connection between easement activity and reduction in the contamination? That is, we're not sure yet, but I would argue probably not because they have been working in those areas. By the way, the impact is from the cause of the pollution is from poultry production, specifically turkey production, and that's the prime, but not exclusively. There's also cattle, a lot of cattle farming going on in the watershed. The second part of your question was, have they included water quality protection in the easements? And the answer is yes, and that's what I was referring to by coupling multiple community priorities. What they have done with some of their easements, specifically those that were implemented through the Corridor H or the Highway Mitigation Funds, was to protect farmland but also require best management practices that were going to either improve or continue to protect water quality. So all of the things that go with, or best management practices that go with water quality protection on agricultural lands, stream fencing, riparian buffers, those types of things, that they were all required in the easement. It's important to also point out, however, that that's an additional institutional capacity issue for the land trust because not only are they monitoring now traditional easement activity, i.e., have you cut down all the forest and built houses, they also are going to have a requirement to make sure that these best management practices stay in place. And so it was important for them to work out arrangements with state agencies and others to make sure that monitoring enforcement was also taking place.
Okay, at this time, if anyone would like to ask a question over the phone, please unmute yourself and give us your name and organization before your question.
I'm Betsy from Rhode Island, DEM.
Go ahead.
Okay, the question is, in regard to the Montgomery County Stormwater Utility, are there incentives for homeowners or citizens to reduce impervious surface by using coarse pavements or LID techniques like rain barrels and rain gardens? Is there some reduction in the fee, or is that included at all?
Yes, it can be reduced by implementing particular best management practices. Rain barrels are a big one. Rain gardens are another one. Reducing impervious surface is one. If you have homeowners who are actually removing driveways with pervious pavers, things like that. So there is a reduction in the fee. That this, again, creates an institutional issue for the communities that are doing this. You have to have the capacity to actually set, ensure that the best management practices are hitting the ground. This is not unique to Montgomery County. There are communities all across the country that are using the fee as an incentive to change behavior. By the way, that's, again, we go back to this market-based issue. That's exactly, ultimately, what we would like to have with all of our programs and tools, taxes and fees, is that they
would somehow change the behavior associated with what you're trying to accomplish. Stormwater fees really are not set high enough to do that in most cases. And even to this point, most of the people that are implementing, putting in rain barrels, putting in rain gardens, are doing it because they want to do the right thing. You're talking about a community where the median household income is pretty high, and so $25 a year is probably not creating the behavior change that might be necessary.
Any other questions?
Hi, this is Christine from Hawaii with the State Division of Forestry and Wildlife. My question is both for either Tim or Dan, and it basically has to do with a lot of points that you talked about regarding political will, and especially with regards to passing things like fees or taxes or credits, maybe regulatory rules and regulations. And I guess I'm just wondering if you could provide some key steps that organizations should think about if they're trying to develop this political will for those types of initiatives.
Things that has been critically important, I guess I'm going to refer to my community and the watershed that I've worked in a lot, which is Chesapeake Bay, has been gauging the political will or the community will to actually solve these problems. And so surveying community has been very, very important. And what we've seen is most people are willing to pay to protect and to restore watersheds. So going through some type of process that actually gauges the community's priorities is going to be really, really important. You know, money, there are certain times that it's going to be easier to move things forward than other times. So, for example, in the state of Maryland, there's a lot of effort right now to get new taxes and fees put in place for watershed protection, but we're facing a budget deficit. And so it's really hit a roadblock because of that issue. If we had a budget surplus, it probably would be easier. Political will would be probably move us along a little bit easier. So I would say that the main thing is to have some type of process in place that gauges community will and then use that information appropriately. The response to this question would probably be a lot longer, but I got about four hands telling me I don't have any more time. So now I really mean it. I'm happy to answer that question further, but you can send me an email. So.
Thanks, Ed. Sorry to cut this short, but our time is up, and this concludes today's Watershed Academy webcast. On behalf of the entire EPA Watershed Academy webcast team, I'd like to thank Tim Jones and Dan Neese for presenting today. And, of course, thanks to every one of you who joined us. This is Ann Weinberg from EPA's Office of Wetlands, Oceans, and Watersheds signing off. Have a great day.